The Blue Jackets are winning again, but can it fill the seats? I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Thomas Bradley. This is After the Score.
Welcome to After the Score from WOSU Public Media. I'm Steve Brown alongside Thomas Bradley. In this week's edition, we'll talk about Columbus's surprisingly deep roots with the National Football League.
And the surprisingly long coaching search by the Cleveland Browns.
But first, the Columbus Blue Jackets have not lived up to expectations this season. Okay, that's pretty kind. The team that barely missed the playoffs last year stunk for the first 2 months of the season and hit a low point in a 7-0 throttling by Edmonton in November. They appear to have righted the ship, at least for now. The Jackets are riding a 4-game winning streak and making a surprising run at the playoffs. Mm-hmm. But the team remains near the bottom of the league in attendance. To find out why, we called Aaron Portsline. He covers the Blue Jackets for the Columbus Dispatch.
Well, I think you could probably do an entire show just on this topic. I think in the larger sense, there's a softening of ticket sales for pro sports teams all over the country. I think people are starting to realize, much to the chagrin of teams, that sitting at home and watching it on TV is not that bad a deal either, that you really don't have to be there. The Green Bay Packers had a hard time selling playoff tickets this year, to the point where companies had to rush in at the last minute and buy tickets just so the game would be on TV in Green Bay, which is unthinkable. Certainly the Blue Jackets aren't anywhere near the realm of an NFL team, much less the Packers. Their problem is they've been so bad for so long that they've lost the trust of some of their hardcore fans, and they've lost, I think, to a large extent, the casual fan that was into it early and then got tired of the losing. And the tickets are expensive, and unless you feel like you're going to be entertained, not always win every game, of course. There's too many games in hockey. But if you don't feel like you're going to be entertained and you go there too many times where the game just flat out isn't entertaining, you have a hard time justifying going back again. I think if you're a hockey fan, it is a really entertaining hockey team right now. But that has not been the case for too many seasons, too many recent seasons. And they're still building trust back with their fans. And I think they've reached a point because of their mess-ups and their poor play on the ice. I think it's going to take them a playoff berth. It's going to take them maybe some playoff wins before they really get this town to look their way again and trust in the product.
Like you mentioned, the Blue Jackets are in their 14th season. And in their franchise history, haven't won a playoff game. They've been in one playoff series where they were swept by the Detroit Red Wings in 2009. The marketing department for the Blue Jackets, they're no stranger to this problem. I've been told I need to join the battle to carry the flag, and they've gone out and told me that I need to see it live. You got to see it live. They've had slogans over the year to try to put people in their seats, and you said that the solution is to field a hockey team that is going to produce some wins. This team on the ice right now is on a little bit of a run. Is there a chance that this could solve the problem?
Yeah, well, they better hope it solves the problem, because if they have a situation where the team begins to win and it's really competitive and the people still don't respond, well, then you've got a real issue on your hands. I don't think they're facing that. I think if this team continues to play as it's played, if they continue to play hard and, again, very entertaining hockey, I think this is the team that people have wanted the last few years, when they saw a team on the ice that, frankly, they couldn't tell if they gave a damn or not. And this team clearly gives a damn. When you watch them play, you see it. You can feel it. They're not the most talented team. They've got a lot of young talent. They're not there yet, but they have a lot of will and a lot of passion in the way they play. I'm not wholly concerned about the market yet. In the past, then the second they won a couple of games, people showed up and started talking playoffs. It takes longer now. People are less trusting of the product. They've lost some people. I don't think they've lost them for good, but they've gone away and they're waiting to be grabbed again. And there's no marketing, there's no slogans, or no commercials that can convince people to come to the rink in droves, other than, oh my God, this is going to be an unbelievable game. This team's playing great right now. I really want to see them play hockey. Until they get back to that point, I don't know what jingle, what phrase, how you could possibly advertise to convince people to come.
You're listening to After the Score from WOSU Public Media, and we're talking about the Blue Jackets hockey team and struggles to fill the seats with Aaron Portsline from the Columbus Dispatch. Aaron, Matt Calvert joked last week that maybe fans would start coming now that a Buckeye football season is over. He was joking, and it was tongue-in-cheek, but is there anything to that? Is it such a football town that they have to wait until the bowl game is over to fill the seats a little more?
You know, I don't know. I mean, it's a big enough city that it shouldn't be that way. And I think that's too easy. I really do. I think Columbus has changed a lot in the last 20 years. I think people here are into pro sports. It's awful big to be a college town, if you know what I mean. This isn't West Lafayette. This isn't South Bend. This is a city, the biggest city in Ohio. How, you know, why Cleveland can support pro sports teams and one doesn't have to wait till the other. I don't know. I think that's too easy. And I know a lot of people joke about that. And maybe there is something to it. People save their money and they go to football games on Saturdays. So when that's over, maybe they go to hockey games more frequently. I'm sure there are some people who fit that bill. I just think if there were enough people in this town convinced that going to watch the local hockey team was going to be a good time, that the kids were going to like it, that it wasn't going to be 3-0 down after the first period, and, oh, my God, what are we doing? How much did we spend for these tickets again, honey? This team is competitive. It's fun to watch. I've not said this before because it hasn't been true for a few years now. I think they'll be back, but I think it's too easy to say, you know, high school football kills them early, Ohio State football hurts them. There's a million excuses you can make for why attendance is down. The only reason, my opinion, it's down is because people don't trust the product yet. Mm-hmm. They should at this point, but I can't convince them to. Not my job to convince them to. Fans, in my opinion, are never wrong. They make the choice with their wallet just like any other business. I think they'll come around, but it's going to take them. Took them 13 years to beat a lot of people out of the building. It's going to take them a few months at least to get some of those people back.
This year, in lieu of an All-Star game, hockey has the Olympic break. You know, could the return of the Olympics spark some interest in Blue Jackets hockey? And, you know, last Olympics, was there any noticeable difference in attendance?
Well, there was not. And I think we're looking at a situation where this may be the last Olympics that the NHL is involved in. It's going to be hard to pull out of the Olympics, I think, but I don't see them going to South Korea in 2018. I don't know where the games are in 2022. I think they're going to take a break in the next one. I think there's a growing sentiment in the league that wonders, what is the benefit of the NHL by going to the Olympics? The European players love it. The North American players now are really starting to weigh the gold medal on par with the Stanley Cup. But you've got a league now in February that's going to, when it's really starting to churn up and get interesting, that's going to close its doors for 3 weeks. And people are going to watch the Olympics. They're going to be delighted with the style of play, the big ice, the talent that's on display there. And then to come back to the NHL again, it can be deflating for some people. And I don't think the league quite bargained for this. I don't suspect that the Olympics is going to drum up a ton of excitement among Blue Jackets fans. There's nobody playing for Team USA as of now. Mm-hmm. Nobody playing for Team Canada. There are 4 players on the Russian team, so that's going to be interesting to see if U.S. or at least Columbus fans begin rooting for Russia if Team USA gets knocked out of it early. And they've got a player playing for Slovakia. So there is some involvement. I don't think the Olympic Games will be used in any way to fan up excitement for the rest of the Blue Jackets season.
We've been talking about Blue Jackets hockey with Aaron Portsline from the Columbus Dispatch. Aaron, thanks again for your time.
Anytime, guys. Thanks for having me.
How many of you knew the National Football League, by far America's most popular sport, was founded right here in Columbus. I certainly didn't know, and I've lived here the better part of a decade.
Yeah, I didn't know either.
Yeah, and check this out. The league's headquarters used to be right across the street from the State House at High and Broad. It was put there by a guy named Joe F. Carr. He founded the NFL here in Columbus. So he's a Columbus native as well. And he's the subject of a book, The Man Who Built the National Football League, Joe F. Carr. It's written by another Columbus native, Chris Willis. Chris, welcome to After the Score.
Thanks for having me.
So Joseph Carr was obviously an interesting guy with this great story. Let's start from the beginning. He grew up in Columbus. Tell us about his life and then how he got involved in the business of football.
Yeah, Joe Carr was was born and raised there in Columbus, Ohio, sort of in where the Irish neighborhood was, kind of where Columbus State is technically now, you know, is where the Irish neighborhood, you know, was.
Near downtown.
He was born in 1879. His dad was a shoemaker and then owned a grocery store slash saloon, you know, during that time, and was really involved in sports growing up, you know, sort of after, what would you call, middle school is when he sort of took off. He became a sports writer first at the Ohio State Journal, and then part-time he was working at the Columbus Panhandle Division of the Pennsylvania Railroad, and that's where he sort of saw some of the football players like the Nesser brothers and the Columbus Panhandles, you know, starting out, you know, with the football. So the sports writing grew into running the football team. He helped run the Columbus Senators baseball team. So sports was always sort of something he loved and gravitated to, although he did not play them. He was a smaller man, you know, under 6 foot, but he loved just, you know, the organization and sort of the potential of, you know, organizing sports and following sports in different realms more than an athlete. And that started right there in Columbus, you know, right there in Central Ohio, and became a very popular man in the sports scene, you know, like I said, starting with his sports writing days and then sort of running baseball and football teams there in Central Ohio.
You know, Chris, I have to be honest. I've lived in Columbus a lot of my life and never heard of the Columbus Panhandles. You know, this is a professional football team from the early 1900s.
I get that a lot, too. I mean, I was born in Columbus. I grew up in German Village. And I think for most of us, we gravitated to high state football. And we loved college football. And then you had the pro teams there in the state. And you kind of forget that the NFL and the Columbus Panhandles, which was an early successful pro team, was established right there, you know, in Central Ohio. And that way, hey, we had a very successful, you know, professional team that got started in the NFL, and you know, they sort of got older once the NFL, you know, sort of took off in the 20s and 30s. And also the popularity of Ohio State took over too. It was going to be a college town. And to give credit to Joe Carr, he saw that. I mean, he was involved in the early days of the NFL. He saw, hey, this is probably going to be a college town. The university is very popular. You know, Ohio Stadium was just being built. You know, they were taking off. He's like, you know what? We need to be in a little bit bigger cities. And So for most Central Ohioans, yeah, Joe Carr and the Columbus Panhandles doesn't ring a bell as much as maybe Ohio State football.
We're talking about Columbus's ties to the National Football League and its founder, Columbus native Joe Carr. We're joined by Chris Willis, the author of the book, The Man Who Built the National Football League, Joe F. Carr. So, Chris, tell us about the NFL's early days. You told us how Mr. Carr founded the league. How did the league start in its infant stages, and then how did it develop into this monstrosity it is now?
Well, especially in the 20s and 30s, and I think that's where Joe Carr kind of gets lost in the history of the National Football League, is he and some of these other owners sort of built what the foundation is now, you know. And he was really one of the big force in that, you know. And one of his main accomplishments was moving the NFL from the small towns of those early years to the big cities and finding financially capable owners to run them. So when you see the Mara family running the Giants now, the Rooney family running, you know, the Pittsburgh Steelers, the Detroit Lions came into the league, you know, the Cleveland Rams, which became now the St. Louis Rams, the Washington Redskins. He helped recruit some of these owners to help solidify the league that sort of, you know, that's what we sit on now.
It was more of a minor league kind of barnstorming type thing back then.
Yeah, there was a lot of travel teams. There was a lot of teams that just would come in for a few years, run out of money, and then and leave. And Joe, you know, saw that. And some of the early owners, like George Halas, you know, and like I said, Art Rooney, they saw, look, in order for us to be more established and have that continuity year in and year out, you know, we need to be in the big cities first, you know, kind of like Major League Baseball at the time, you know, that only had about 12 teams. and we need financially capable owners that sort of, hey, they might take some hits early. I mean, the Rooney family and the Mara family, they lost a lot of money in those early years. And then they saw that, hey, this could be a really good sport. It could be popular. Let's make it entertaining. And they saw that as those early owners. And that helped sort of where we sit now. You know, when you look at back at it and you look at some of these, you know, owners that are well established and the cities that they're in, you know, it's not minor league. It's not, you know, year to year. Oh, we're going to have these franchises. We're going to have these players. You know, it's pretty well established. And that was, like I said, at the end of the 30s, that was being established, and they were, you know, 10 teams. They were very, you know, successful. You know, they were going to be successful. They had owners that wanted to be successful. And that's where Carr sort of, you know, influences those, you know, what we sit on today is, hey, this is where the NFL could be.
Yeah, just a few things that Joe Carr did. He created the organization's first constitution, implemented standard player contracts, and helped develop the NFL draft. So he was really ahead of his time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there were things that, you know, now we take for granted. You look at, oh, wow, that's been in place for 50 years. But back then, they were new, you know, to do, you know, hey, contracts so players don't jump from team to team, you know, to have constitution and bylaws, you know, to follow. And the draft was another huge thing. That was a big gamble for those owners, you know, that, hey, the Bears and the Giants and the big cities, they were dominating the NFL at that time, you know, winning championships. And those teams like Philadelphia and Pittsburgh were just getting, they were struggling. But the Bears and the Giants had all the money to get the best players. And they were. But Hallis and Mara and some of those players or some of those owners sacrificed, say, look, and Carr led it, say, look, this is better for the league. When the players come in now, the teams that had the worst records now get the best opportunity to get those players, you know.
Yeah.
So that, and like I said, now we take that for granted. Oh, that's easy. It's competitive balances, you know, what they call it. But a lot of those early things were just getting started. They were just brand new. Hey, let's do a draft. You know, like I said, let's do statistics. Let's split the National Football League into two, you know, divisions and have a world championship game. All that stuff was being discussed, in the 20s and throughout the 30s. And now we take that for granted.
We're talking about Columbus's ties to the National Football League and its founder, Columbus native Joseph Carr. We're speaking with Chris Willis, who wrote the book, The Man Who Built the National Football League, Joe F. Carr.
Yeah, Columbus was headquartered, or the NFL was headquartered in Columbus while Joe Carr was president. Did the NFL kind of reach its ceiling in Columbus and have to move on? Or are there any current connections to the NFL in Columbus right now?
Well, to your first part of your question, yes. When Joe Carr became the NFL president in 1921, which was the second year of the National Football League, Jim Thorpe was the first year, and he was an athlete. He was not an administrator. So Joe Carr took over, and the first thing he did was set up a headquarters. We need a headquarters, and he put it right there in Columbus, Ohio. It's a Broad and High, 16 East Broad. You know, the Hayden Building is still there. So if you're down there at the intersection, that's where the first NFL office was. And then, unfortunately, when he passed away in 1939, he was still in office. You know, he passed away from a second heart attack. He still would have kept the office there. You know, it bounced around a little once they started getting new commissioners. They went to Chicago first and then Philadelphia with Burt Bell, and then obviously to New York when Pete Rozelle became commissioner. But that's a really nice historical, you know, piece of history there in Columbus that, hey, we have the first, you know, headquarters, and it's still there. The building is still there. The 11th floor there, you know, at that building at 16 East Broad. But right now, because of the popularity of Ohio State, like I said, it gets totally lost. I think a lot of people, you know, like I said, we've talked about, you know, Columbus not, you know, knowing that history. Hey, we were part of the early history of the NFL, you know, with the headquarters and an early, you know, pro team. And but now there's no historical marker down there. There's no sort of recognition down there, which is a little unfortunate. I think slowly but surely some people are starting to recognize that, you know, hopefully, you know, some people there, you know, within the offices down there, you know, can kind of, hey, this is part of our history. But it does get lost. I don't think it comes to mind very quickly for people there in Central Ohio that, hey, this is where a really good early NFL history is still there.
Yeah, like I said, I've lived in Columbus a long time and never even knew about this. Well, this has been a really great informative discussion. Chris Willis wrote the book, The Man Who Built the National Football League, Joe F. Carr, who was from Columbus and wrote about Columbus being the first home, the first headquarters of the National Football League. Chris, thanks again.
Thanks, Steve and Thomas, for having me. Appreciate it.
Chris Palmer, Butch Davis, Terry Rubisky, Romeo Crennel, Eric Mangini, Pat Shermer, and Rod Chudzinski. I'm sorry if that list triggers any PTSD symptoms for Cleveland Browns fans. That's the sad, sad list of people who have coached the team since it returned to the NFL in 1999, and they're about to add another victim or name to the list, whatever you want to call it.
The Browns are still looking for a head coach more than 2 weeks after firing Rob Jasinski, just 1 year into the job. They're the last team to hire a coach after firing their coach this
year. Well, last is a word connected to the Browns quite a bit, and it's probably not going to stop anytime soon. They've become the laughingstock of the league. They're not always last in the NFL, which actually would have some benefits. They would get guys like Andrew Luck or Teddy Bridgewater coming into the draft this year. They always find a way to not please the fans and also not get the best players. And this whole thing, this whole dragged-on coaching search just makes them look like amateurs.
Well, if they did have the first pick, they'd probably trade it away for a later first-round pick later.
Right, they need that long snapper.
Really important. And they're not just the Jaguars. They didn't draft a punter over, you know, Russell Wilson. But, you know, the Browns have added a couple guys to their radar, two guys that are still coaching in the playoffs right now. So obviously they can't hire them before that. So that might be part of the reason why they haven't hired a coach. Adam Gase, the Broncos offensive coordinator, and Dan Quinn, the Seahawks defensive coordinator, they both play this weekend. But every other team that has fired their coach at the end of the last season has already replaced them with who they think is a suitable candidate. And most of those candidates were on the Browns list, and the Browns just didn't get the coaches to come there.
And neither of these guys would be a bad hire. Adam Gase has certainly had some really good success in Denver running that offense along with Peyton Manning, and Dan Quinn running a great defense in Seattle. I'm not terribly excited about either candidate either. I mean, getting back to your comment about the Browns not getting any of the coaches that have already been hired by other teams, a big reason by that, we've seen reports that Rod Jasinski is talking trash about Browns management to those candidates.
We did see those reports, and we saw the Browns' response yesterday, a letter to all fans saying, this job is desirable, and we think the head coaching position of the Cleveland Browns is one of the best jobs in the country.
In 1964, yes, it was a great job.
Today?
No, it's not. It's still, the Browns have the biggest fan club in the world of any sport. It's bigger than Real Madrid. It's bigger than the Yankees. It's bigger than the Green Bay Packers.
You're a little delusional.
No, it's true. Number-wise, they really do have the biggest fan club. And it's so sad that they have this amazing opportunity in a great football town, and they waste it, it seems. I don't know. I know they're trying to get the right guy, but they can never get the right guy. This team, it really seems cursed.
We're here in Columbus, so we don't have an NFL team here. And right. The Columbus fan base is kind of split three ways. There's mm-hmm. the Pittsburgh Steelers, there's the Cincinnati Bengals, and there's the Cleveland Browns. The Browns need to dip in, you know, to the Columbus market to kind of get some momentum. And who's one guy that they could get that would win over every Columbus fan? One guy? His name is Jim Tressel.
His name is Jim Tressel. He might be a good hire. I don't know. He can't be any worse than Chris Palmer or Pat Shurmur.
Former head coach of the Ohio State Buckeyes who was run out of town after right. his mess with Tattoo Gate. But there have been reports that Jim Tressel said he is interested in a head coaching position in the NFL.
You could do worse than Tressel, I guess. I mean, Rod Jasinski was fired a year into the job.
Well, that's another thing, too. What coach wants to come here when you get 1 year to put your system in place, and then if you don't go to the playoffs, you're out? Like, that's a raw deal.
Yeah, Ian Rappaport from NFL Network was tweeting that a lot of people around the league view the Browns' job as, quote, radioactive.
It really is. I don't know if I'd want to take it. Yeah, I probably would because, yeah, I'd be rich and famous and be a head coach of the NFL, but I'd be done after 1 year if I don't make the playoffs.
I don't know if that's true. A lot of coaches have survived at least a couple years in Cleveland. A couple years is the benchmark of success in Cleveland. Yeah, I don't know who they're going to hire. It's probably going to be Gase or Quinn, but who knows? The Browns, they can't get anything right. They're the Charlie Browns. Rob Aller had it right when he called them the Charlie Browns.
The Browns have the fourth pick in the draft this year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so what pick combined with what coach is going to make things most interesting in Cleveland?
I would have said Charlie Strong and Teddy Bridgewater, but Charlie Strong has taken the head coaching job at the University of Texas. I don't know. Adam Gase, he cut his teeth as a quarterback coach. So you would think if they hire Gase, they're going to get a guy to develop, a guy like Bridgewater, a guy like Johnny Manziel, the quarterback from Central Florida. I can't remember his name. But you would think if they get Gase, it'd be a perfect marriage with the quarterback. It's hard telling. They have a lot of picks in the draft, in the May draft, and so they could package something together and move up to get Bridgewater, who'll probably be the number one pick. I don't know. Nothing will surprise me.
Blake Bortles is the quarterback from
Blake
Central
Bortles.
Florida.
Yeah.
Who no one knows his name.
Right, who I've never been less excited about anyone than Blake Bortles from UCF. But he could be good. I don't know. I don't know. Nothing will surprise me. And that will do it for After the Score from WOSU Public Media. I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Thomas Bradley. You can always find us online at wosu.org/afterthescore or search on Twitter @afterthescore.